Welcome to In the Studio. I'm Redbeard with a 21st century perspective behind history's greatest rock and roll bands.
Guitar up.
One, two, three.
Today, in the studio, it's the band that plugged into folk music with electrifying results.
We didn't like the song. I don't know if Gwen told you this, but most of us didn't think that was the right song to do, and we kept thinking going in more of a Beatle direction, but Dixon talked us into it.
I think, me personally, I think Roger delivers McGuinn, delivers Dylan's songs better than he does, but, you know, he's always liked how we did them. The importance of it really was the incredible poetry that Dylan wrote that we managed to translate, and again, the credit goes largely to Roger, translate into, you know, real rock and roll.
And I said, "What's the matter, Gene?" He said, I got to get off this plane, man. He said, "It's going to crash. I know it's going to crash." And I said, "Wow, man, you know." I wondered for a minute if he was having some kind of premonition. And then I thought, no, you know, I don't think so. And so we all kind of said, "Well, what are you going to do?" He said, "I got to get off this plane." And so he started off the plane. And I said, "Gene, if you can't fly, you can't be a bird." And he walked off the plane. And that was when he quit the group.
8 miles high. Touchdown. I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
In 1965, a Southern California quintet reluctantly recorded a Bob Dylan song, recommended by their producer. Subsequently, when the recording of Mr. Tambourine Man went to number one, the Byrds were credited with inventing folk rock. By electrifying acoustic folk music, the Byrds had lent a new credibility to rock and roll and brought a new, broader audience to traditional folk music. By further popularizing the songs of Bob Dylan, the Byrds, as students, undoubtedly influenced the master, Dylan, to follow them, at least in form. Their soaring harmonies and Roger McGuinn's signature style on electric 12-string guitar created a new sound unmistakably their own, indelibly leaving their mark a quarter century later on Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, REM, just to name a few. Later, the Byrds, with some personnel changes, would almost single-handedly spawn yet another musical movement known as country rock. But today we're in the studio for the original Byrds era, focusing on the albums Mr. Tambourine Man, Fifth Dimension, Turn, 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 and Younger Than Yesterday. The original five-man Byrds lineup was drummer Michael Clark with an E on the end, singer-songwriter Gene Clark, no relation, Chris Hillman on bass, Jim McGuinn, who later changed his first name to Roger, and David Crosby. Roger McGuinn and then David Crosby share their musical backgrounds prior to forming the Byrds.
We all came out of a folk background. David was a solo folk artist. I was an accompanist for a couple of groups, and then I went solo, and Hillman actually was from an amazingly similar background. I didn't know this until recently, but he was influenced by Presley and Gene Vincent and Carl Perkins, and then he went into Pete Seeger and the Weavers and stuff like that, the same influence as I had. I always thought he was more country influenced because he does tend to go in that direction, and David had a lot more jazz influence than I did, and so we did have definite different accents, different areas that we liked better than others.
Yeah, Roger, you know, had all the picking and stuff from Chicago, you know, folk music scene, and I had listened to some jazz, but also was into folk music. My mother actually is the one who turned me on to folk music. She played Weavers and Pete Seeger and Josh White and Odetta and people like that. And Christopher really loved bluegrass and folk and country, you know. So we had overlapping folk in the middle with other, you know, tinges around the edge.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there ain't no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song. jingle, jangle morning, I'll come following you. Take me for a trip upon your magic swirling ship. All my senses have been stripped, and my hands can't feel to grip, and my toes too numb to step. Wait only for my boot heels to be wandering. I'm ready to go anywhere. I'm ready for to fade onto my own parade. Cast your dancing spell my way. I promise to go under it. Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. I'm not sleepy and there ain't no place I'm going to. Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I'll come following you.
Crystallizing Roger McGuinn's vision of merging the poetic folk music of Bob Dylan with the miraculous pop sounds of the British Invasion, writes Jason Ankeny in the All Music Guide, who reminds us that Roger McGuinn was the only member of the Byrds to actually play on their landmark debut single. But McGuinn's jangly 12-string electric Rickenbacker guitar became the very definition of the burgeoning folk rock form, end quote. Yet the Byrds' version of Dylan's Mr. Tambourine Man almost didn't happen, according to Byrds' bass player Chris Hillman.
We didn't like the song. I don't know if McGuinn told you this, but most of us didn't think that was the right song to do, and we kept thinking going in more of a Beatle direction, but Dixon talked us into it. I didn't understand the song, and then I did understand it later. I understand what Jim was trying to tell us, Dixon. And he was absolutely right, and we were very young at the time, and he was molding us at that point, and trying to make us see what he could see and the potential we had. He was trying to give us direction as far as be aware of lyrics and of a poetic thing. Do something good that will stand up over the years, and he's absolutely right. Don't go for the quick fix. Don't go for that quick hit song.
I asked Chris Hillman if he thought the number one success of the Byrds' version of Mr. Tambourine Man influenced Dylan's subsequent decision to go electric.
We're dealing with a situation where the acoustic folk music had just peaked out, and college kids got into folk music very heavily, and it became so popular that they ended up with a horrible network TV show called Hootenanny, hosted by Art Linkletter's son. And it just had just gone out of proportion. So I think at the time, Dylan, regardless of the Byrds or not, probably would have eventually gone electric because his musical taste, I'm sure, extended far beyond just acoustic music.
Original Byrds, David Crosby and Roger McGuinn with me in the studio.
The real importance of Dylan wasn't so much the endorsement of us, you know, which took place naturally enough because he liked us. He just liked what we did. You know, we've always done his songs well. I think Roger delivers Dylan's songs better than he does, but, you know, he's always liked how we did them. The importance of it really was the incredible poetry that Dylan wrote that we managed to translate, and again, the credit goes largely to Roger, translate into, you know, real rock and roll, into music with a backbeat to it and a real roll to it, you know. That was the real synthesis that really, you know, was important, was taking those lyrics and that kind of feel. And Dylan loved that, we loved that, everybody loved that.
I do think, though, that Dylan's endorsement of us, his appearance on the album cover, on the back of it, and the fact that he sat in with us at Ciro's, and it did give us credibility that we might not have had otherwise.
I think he meant it, too.
I ain't looking to compete with you, beat or cheat or mistreat you, simplify you,
pacify you, deny, defy, or crucify you. All I really wanna do is maybe be friends with you. No, I ain't looking to fight with you, frighten you, or apathy you, drag you down or bring you down, chain you down or bring you down. All I really wanna do is maybe be friends with you. Or be like me. I don't want to meet you again, make you spin or do you in, or select you or dissect you, or inspect you or reject you. All I really want to do is maybe be friends. Baby, be friends with you. Baby, be friends with you.
All I Really Want to Do, written by Bob Dylan, appeared on the Byrds' debut album. Chris Hillman had played mandolin in Southern California bluegrass band the Golden State Boys, later named the Hillmen, with a pun on Chris's surname.
We were doing Dylan songs before the Byrds even thought of that. So Dixon, having worked with me a year prior to the Byrds, they needed a bass player. David was going to be the bass player. They were going to have a quartet. It would be David, Gene, and they had a drummer, Mike Clark, and Jim McGuinn. David didn't feel comfortable on the bass. He couldn't quite understand it. And so they asked me if I wanted to be the bass player. I had never played bass, so I really approached the bass as if I was playing bluegrass rhythm guitar, and I just went for it. It sounded like a good idea. I liked the way the three of them sang. I heard some of their stuff, and they sounded good, and it was a nice opportunity.
Even with an ace on their first serve, the Byrds had to pay their dues, even in Hollywood. Here's Roger McGuinn, followed by David Crosby.
We got to play Jane Fonda's Party.
That was fun.
Yeah, we played Jane Fonda and Roger Vadim's Party. Or just Jane Fonda's birthday party, right?
Yeah, something.
Yeah, and Peter Fonda, Henry Fonda was there, and he kept saying, "Turn those boys down, they're so loud," you know, and Peter would come up and say, "Oh, Dad, they're just, you know, that's how they play." He said, "Turn them down." And so Peter said, "Oh, they'll turn down." And he came over to me and said, "Don't worry about my dad, he just doesn't know anything about music. Keep playing as loud as you want," you know.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. We had a great time, man. We still knew we weren't at the top of the heap because we were opening for bands like the Rolling Stones, you know, and it was obvious to us that there was more to do here than what we were doing yet. But we had a great time.
Of course, we were still playing bowling alleys and stuff, you know, when we had a number one record. Our management team was a little bit on the, you know, sort of learning side. There was a learning curve there. And, you know, they had us playing gymnasiums and in like a bus with seats in it, you know. And like it wasn't first-class luxury tour.
No, yeah. As a matter of fact, our first bus tour, man, we used, until it broke down, we used a trailway bus with the regular seats in it.
Yeah.
None of this deal where you had bunks and showers and a microwave, you know, no TV games. This was like, you know, fight you for the back seat.
They may never have been completely birds of a feather, but Chris Hillman explains how the musical diversity was unified by one musical phenomenon in 1964-65.
They had really no concept of bluegrass or traditional country music, and Roger came out of a folk background, but more of a, not your eclectic folk, more like of the Limelighters, the Brothers Four, the Kingston Trio, that kind of stuff, which I never could stand. David sort of came out of that background, and Gene was a Christy minstrel, and Michael had a background, I guess, and he knew blues, and he knew Muddy Waters and stuff like that. And he had actually more access to rock and roll than any of us. My background, of course, was straight bluegrass, and having varied backgrounds musically, it created this strange band, and it created that strange sound that we came up with. God knows how, by osmosis, it came out. And also the fact that when we started out and we had no money, Jim Dixon once again had access to this recording studio, World Pacific, which was a jazz label, had a small studio, three-track machine or something, I don't know, two-track or something, and we would go in and rehearse every night. And I think isolating ourselves like that, and originally we wanted to be the Beatles. And when I met the three guys, they were doing Beatles songs, and then even the songs that Gene was writing, they were very Beatlesque.
The reason why, oh, I can't say, I have to let you go, and right away, after what you did, I can't stay on, and I probably feel a whole lot better when you're gone.
One of my favorite songs of all time has got to be Gene Clark's I'll Feel a Whole Lot Better from the Byrds' debut album, Mr. Tambourine Man. When we come back, the bird who couldn't fly, plus the curse of being branded America's answer to the Beatles. Follow us on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and check out a whole lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Roger McGuinn, David Crosby, and Chris Hillman of the original Byrds in the studio. Welcome back in the studio for the best of the early Byrds, including their albums Turn, 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 Fifth Dimension, and Younger Than Yesterday. I'm Redbeard. Chris Hillman of the Byrds reminds us of the mood of the time in which the Byrds were hatched.
I saw some odd people, and I'd never been exposed to that kind of rock club atmosphere or Hollywood or any of that stuff. So it was probably more interesting for me than the other guys. I was a kid out of the country, you know. I'd just come to L.A. the year before that. I'd grew up in a rural town, and you didn't have that excessive moronic drug use, which rock and roll turned into in the late 70s. And you know, it was a very fresh thing. It was the beginning of the 60s, and it had not quite, I think everybody was in the entire country, if not the world, were picking themselves up after the Kennedy assassination. And I think the Kennedy situation, and by 64, everybody was trying to go on with their lives. It was devastating. It was probably the beginning of the decline of the country at that point. And our generation grew up in probably the most prosperous time in the history of the country, if not the 1890s, was probably the other time. But the 1950s were the most prosperous time in America, in post-war there, and we all, the people born during the war or the beginning of 1941, was spoiled rotten in the 50s. We had television, and it was the average middle-class family had the two-car garage, and everybody owned a home, and only dad worked then. And nobody got divorced. Mom and dad stuck it out through thick and thin. And it was a different time then. And yes, there we were, the spoiled kids getting out there to change. Well, with good intention, by all means. And I wish that feeling was still around on campus today. But folks are still too busy getting those marketing degrees. So.
Birds Turn, Turn, Turn was music by Pete Seeger and lyrics from the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament Bible. It was another hit in 1965 for the Birds. The flight path of the Birds was soaring rapidly after only two albums. But boarding a coast-to-coast flight, one of the Birds fell out of the nest. Here's Roger McGuinn.
I showed up just at the last minute, and the plane was just closing the door at the gate. It was a 707, and we were on our way to New York to do a Murray the K special. And it was a big deal because Murray the K was the fifth Beatle. He was a hot guy in New York, and so we were real jazzed about it. We were also going to do some sort of a fashion spread with Vogue or something like that. I don't know. We were, you know, into all kinds of things back there. And I got on the plane, and I walked to the place where we were all sitting, And Gene was standing up, and his brow was beaded with perspiration. He was in a cold sweat, and you could feel like an aura of fear around him for 5 feet. It gripped you when you walked into it. It was like overwhelming. It was like something that you felt like you were just being dangled by your feet from the top of a 40-story building or something. It was an incredibly scary feeling. And I said, "What's the matter, Gene?" He said, I got to get off this plane, man." He said, "It's going to crash. I know it's going to crash." You know, I said, "Wow, man." You know, I wondered for a minute if he was having some kind of premonition. And then I thought, no, you know, I don't think so. And so we all kind of said, "Well, what are you going to do?" He said, "I got to get off this plane." And so he started off the plane. And I said, "Gene, if you can't fly, you can't be a bird." And he walked off the plane. And that was when he quit the group.
Show you once and we'll be free. Please let me love you and it won't be wrong. Every time I see you smile, come to me, don't be long. Let me tell you how my heart goes wild. Let me love you and it won't be wrong. Let me love you, then you'll see. Come to me, come to me. Let me show you once and we'll be free. Please let me love you and it won't be wrong. Please let me love you and it won't be wrong. Please let me love you and it won't be wrong.
A wonderful chestnut from the Byrds' second album in 1965 is the Roger McGuinn song, It Won't Be Wrong. It's now a bonus track on the Super Audio CD version of the Byrds' greatest hits. Though Gene Clark left before their third album, Fifth Dimension, Chris Hillman admits that Gene Clark had star quality.
He left, and most people understand that. He just didn't feel comfortable, and at the time, Gene had everything going for him. He could have been a major solo artist. Out of all of us, he could have been a major solo artist. He had a presence on stage that we were all in the shadow of sometimes. I mean, he really, when he was in control, and he had personal emotional problems that prevented that from happening.
There were some new sounds on the Fifth Dimension Byrds album, less folksy and more electric. The Byrds relying exclusively on their own songwriting this time. David Crosby and Roger McGuinn tell how.
It was partly because Gene left. It was partly because we aren't the kinds of people who keep doing the same thing over and over again. We keep growing, and we're going to keep growing.
We didn't want to be locked into a box musically or any other way, and our whole approach to music was to keep a kaleidoscopic change going on so that people couldn't really pin us down, and also to keep it interesting for ourselves.
We just kept growing as musicians, you know, and we would try more and more stuff. We got into synthesizing sounds before there were synthesizers. We got into, you know, sequencing stuff into the records before there were sequencers. We wanted to stretch. We wanted to push back the barriers. We wanted to do new things. We did songs that didn't have any rhythm to them. We did songs that had backwards stuff in them. We did songs, you know, that were lyrically entirely different from anything anybody had tried before. We wanted to experiment. You know, we wanted to be innovators. And rather than replace the open, airy, you know, simple folk, you know, style that we started out with, that wasn't really a simple folk style we started out with. What we did was we synthesized that kind of feel into where instead of an acoustic guitar playing it, Roger was playing it on this godlike electric 12-string, man. This thing had wings of its own, you know. And we just kind of augmented it. We added, we would experiment, you know. You'd hear a jet engine, or you'd hear, you know, Martians talking at you, you know, or you'd hear, you know, the sound of computerized space language coming over the airwaves. We wanted to take you on a trip.
Also, Crosby turned me on to John Coltrane around that time, and that had a tremendous bearing on my guitar playing. I really tried pretty hard to emulate the saxophone style of Coltrane on the 12-string.
We were on this tour, okay, and it was the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars, and everybody else was all riding on one bus. Now, that's the Wee Five, Bo Diddley, and Paul Revere and the Raiders. Wow. And we said, no, I don't think so. So we got our own little a mobile home and followed him around, but on our own. And we had an enormous speaker in there hooked up to it. Roger had hooked up a Fender amp?
A Fender amp and a Philips cassette deck. And Philips had just come out with the cassette machine. It was a brand new deal.
Brand new gizmo.
Nothing
brand new
like
gizmo.
It before ever in the world, you know.
Yeah, and we hooked it up so that it would play, you know, these tapes we had of, you know, all kinds of stuff, Beatles, Ravi Shankar, John Coltrane, all kinds of people we loved, right? And so there we are, we got John Coltrane blasting over this thing, I mean loud, and we pull up to this, this railroad crossing, and there in front of us was a train full of coal, and we said, Coltrane! Cosmic Man!
Woke up this morning with light in my eyes, and then realized it was still dark outside. It was a light coming down from the sky. I don't know who or why. Must be those strangers that come every night. Those saucer-shaped lights put people uptight. Leave blue-green footprints that glow in the dark. I hope they get home all right. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride? This morning I was feeling quite weird. Had flies in my beard, my toothpaste was smeared. Over my window they'd written my name. Said, so long, we'll see you again. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride? Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along? I won't do anything wrong. Hey, Mr. Spaceman, won't you please take me along for a ride?
Mr. Spaceman from the Byrds' 1966 album Fifth Dimension was written by Roger McGuinn. Prior to its release, the Byrds' American meteoric success had caught the eye of former Beatles publicist at Apple Records, Englishman Derek Taylor, who was hired to orchestrate a huge campaign to coincide with the Byrds' first English tour. Here's Chris Hillman.
It wasn't a pleasant experience because, A, we were too tired. We had been out on the road all summer. We needed a break, and we went to England, and really it was the Eddie and Jim, Eddie Tickner and Jim Dixon, our managers, were saying, don't go, take a break. Derek Taylor, our publicity man, wanted us to go, and I think really Derek wanted to go back over to England and say, look what I did since leaving the Beatles. I have a group that's doing something too. I think, and it's speculation, and I love Derek, but I'm sure he wanted to march back into England triumphantly with a group with a number one record. And basically, we were tired, but we went over there, and it was a mistake in hindsight. We shouldn't have gone right then, but we hooked up with a horrible promoter, horrible man, and took advantage of us, put us in venues that were bad. He booked us in a jazz club in Soho. I mean, it was just bad, and you can't expect it. I'm sure the press were gunning for us, but we go over there on four cylinders and not playing very well in these bad venues, and they tore it up.
Original Byrds David Crosby and Roger McGuinn.
The worst thing this guy did to us was that he decided that the right way to advertise us was to tell everybody that we were the American Beatles.
America's answer to the Beatles, America's coming answer. To your neighborhood theater.
Yeah, and it was terrible, of course, because we weren't anywhere near as good as the Beatles. And the Beatles knew that. They were real nice to us.
Besides, in England, that was like saying that you were America's answer to the Queen or something, you know.
Yeah, it was a hopeless thing to do. They actually, the nicest thing that happened was that the Beatles realized we had been, you know, completely savagely booby-trapped, and they came to our shows. They came to our shows and they were really nice. It was a horrible tour though, man, because we were all sick and it was our first time abroad. It was funny.
We got to meet him that time. Derek Taylor set up a meeting upstairs in the above a little club called Blazes that we just played, where Hillman had broken a bass string, and it was a horrible, horrible set. And I was real embarrassed. And we went upstairs and we met John and Paul and George. And was Ringo there?
Yeah.
Yeah. And they said, great show, guys. And I went, oh.
God, we said, thanks, you're so kind, but it was terrible.
Yeah, really.
Inspired by their first transatlantic experience, the Byrds, from their third album Fifth Dimension, with the legendary 8 Miles High. But stardom provoked scrutiny, and controversy would knock the Byrds out of midair. I'm Redbeard. Follow us on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and you can get a whole lot more at inthestudio.net. I'm in the studio with original Byrds Roger McGuinn, David Crosby, and Chris Hillman with me. Welcome back in the studio for the best of the early Byrds. I'm Redbeard. The song 8 Miles High was poised to be quite possibly the biggest song of the entire year 1966. Writing in the All Music Guide, Richie Unterberger contends, and I quote, 8 Miles High, with its astral lyrics, pumping bass line, and fractured guitar solo, was one of the greatest singles of the 60s, end quote. But an influential radio power broker boycotted 8 Miles High, accusing the Byrds of encouraging drug use. After getting slagged by the British press, this smear campaign threatened to blow the Byrds out of midair. First, Roger McGuinn, then David Crosby with me in the studio.
We wrote it on the Clark Cortez tour, on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars tour, and it was while we were listening to the tape of Ravi Shankar on one side and John Coltrane on the other that we sort of got saturated or brainwashed with this music, and we wanted to write a song. We didn't know what we were going to say in it, and we said, well, let's write it about that tour we just came off of, because it was a tough experience. We were crucified over there by the press. I mean, they really hated us. The kids liked us. The little girls screamed and everything. It was fun for them, but the press was really mean to us. And we came back with our tails kind of between our legs, and we wrote the song about the jet lag, the fact that the streets over there are, you know, like you look up 2 stories and there'll be like a street sign on a building or something. It's not like it is in Hollywood and Vine, you know, where you can see two signs on a post and know where you are. You know, around the squares, huddled in storms, some laughing, some just shapeless forms. You know, it was like, that was a story about that. And the 8 Miles High was actually started out to be 6 Miles High. That was the altitude of the plane. And we decided to change it to 8 because we liked the sound of the word better. So that's what the song was about. And,
Now, of course, when we got back and put it out, they decided this was right when Dylan had put out Everybody Must Get Stoned. And they decided that these 2 songs were drug songs, and they pulled us both off the air just as we were about to have a number one record with it. But it's one of the things that I'm most proud of that we did, actually. I think the lyrics were good and the feel was good, and it was an incredibly, you know, innovative record, I thought. We thought it was kind of unfair, you know, if that one person or one, you know, tip sheet could, you know, so effectively censor, you know, the freedom of expression, you know, and in the airwaves, you know. And we thought that was unfair and kind of un-American. We don't like censorship anyway, and the song wasn't about drugs, and we didn't think that it was fair, you know.
It was really an effective band back then, though. It did get us off of, I guess, 90% of the stations.
The Byrds had little choice but to vent their indignation by recording the McGuinn-Hillman song So You'll Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star. That was Thanksgiving 1966 for inclusion on their fourth album, Younger Than Yesterday. Inspired by and featuring the trumpet solo of Hugh Masekela, So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star was Southern California meets South Africa. It was all meant to be a gentle swipe at the music biz in general and the Monkees' contrived television hype in particular. Here's Chris Hillman.
I had done a session for Hugh Masekela, and I had got so much influence in the 2 or 3 days of doing little session demo sessions for Hugh, and he was cutting this South African singer, Letambulu, and I was playing bass, and I was surrounded with South African people, and it was such an influence on me, I can't tell you. It was so exciting. I mean, I came home from that session and wrote Time Between, the first song I'd ever written. And basically, the rock and roll star, ba da da da. It was my little African thing I had gotten from Cecil, the piano player for Hugh. I don't remember. I think that was his name, Cecil. Wonderful people. But it was, God, what an experience. You take a little middle class white boy from rural Southern California and thrust him into a wonderful, whole other rhythmic world that I'd never even seen. I don't think there was a black person where I grew up. It was mostly Hispanic. But it was quite, it was so exciting that I came home and I wrote that. But that's where that riff came, ba-da-da-da.
Chris Hillman would later become one of only two key figures in the development of country rock, along with Gram Parsons, virtually defining the genre through seminal work with the Byrds, then the Flying Burrito Brothers, according to Jason Ankeny in the All Music Guide. Chris Hillman analyzes the members of the Flock.
David's background in harmony was like very jazz oriented, the way he approached harmony and still does. There's very four freshmen and high lows and all of that stuff. He had that sort of Brian Wilson background about harmony singing as opposed to a straight country type approach to harmony, you know. So that was different. And the bass, I'm sure I played bass weird. I didn't play it like anybody else. I never played off the kick drum too much. And McCartney was a big influence on me. I thought he was a fabulous bass player, and he is. And McGuinn, you know, his 12 string, but that's it. Those three items. And Gene's songwriting, I'm certainly, that's your, if you want to break it down molecularly, that's Gene's lyric and Roger's vocal delivery and 12-string and the bass and David's sense of harmony was those factors. And once again, as we said earlier, you're taking individuals from such varied musical backgrounds and putting them all in a mixing bowl and hope to God a cake comes out that is palatable. That's it. And it was. It worked. Doesn't always work, but it worked.
David Crosby left the Nest after the Byrds' 1967 appearance at the Monterey Pop Festival, the movie of which is now available on DVD by D.A. Pennybaker. Crosby would then hook up his harmonies with the Hollies' Graham Nash and Buffalo Springfield's Stephen Stills. But sitting backstage at a 1989 Byrds reunion concert with Roger McGuinn at his side, David Crosby distills the essence of the Byrds.
I have felt since the beginning that the essence of what was really remarkable and, in a sense, important about the Byrds was mostly in Roger's ability to tell a tale and his ability to take a song and bring a certain style to it and play it a certain way. But it's, I think, the way he sees a song, the way he hears it, the way he, you know, shapes a song is to me the most important part of it. I think I added a good thing in the harmonies because that is, you know, a natural thing for me. Obviously, it's something I've always loved to do. And of course, in the Byrds, like I had a wonderful open field there because I wasn't doing three-part harmony. It was mostly Roger singing the lead and me singing a harmony, and that gives you all this room, you know, to work different, you know, relationships to the melody with, and that gets very emotional. It was really wonderful that way.
Older than I'm younger than that now.
Half right prejudice leap for rip down all hate I scream. Lies that life is black and white spoke from my skull I dream. to bow.
Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
Deceived me into thinking I had something to protect. Good and bad, I defined these terms quite clear, no doubt, somehow.
Ah, but I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now.
A Song for the Ages by Bob Dylan, an interpretation written in my soul by the Byrds, the song My Back Pages. The Byrds were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1991. Along the way, directly influencing in turn Dylan himself, the Beatles' George Harrison, Tom Petty, and R.E.M., just to name a few. 3 months after the Rock Hall ceremony, Gene Clark passed away. Drummer Michael Clark passed away in late 1994 of liver disease. David Crosby, on the other hand, underwent a successful liver transplant, and like Chris Hillman and Roger McGuinn, continues to record music. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests, Chris Hillman, David Crosby, and Roger McGuinn. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2013, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and check out more at inthestudio.net.